Part 4. Evacuation. Chapter 17. To my relief, and no small astonishment, I realized that I was down, alive, and mostly unhurt. The dropship was perfectly still. Through my visor, and the curve of the transparent segment of the hull beyond it, I made out a low rust-colored ridge which seemed to be a few hundred meters away. Nearer me was an area of sloping ground dotted with small, sharp boulders. The sky was a pale buff, deceptively bright. It did not take many atoms to scatter the sun's radiation in a way that suggested the full, comforting blanket of a breathable atmosphere. I was on my side, nearly horizontal. None of the other dropships were to be seen, although a few faint smoke trails still lingered in the air. I ran a systems review. If I had a broken limb or irreparable damage to my suit, my mission was finished. None of us was indispensable, and the others could find workarounds for my absence. But the suit was intact. A good thing, too, as I would be totally dependent on it for my entire spell on Mars. The dropship was finished, its outer skin burned to a crisp, but that was to be expected. It had never been meant to do more than get me onto the surface. Its only remaining task was to conceal itself. As for my body, the toll of damage was about as serious as it could be without actually preventing me from continuing. I had neither broken nor dislocated any limbs. I did have a bruised or fractured rib or two, and there was ligament and muscle damage around my hips and knees. I had suffered mild concussion during the landing, and had a small retinal bleed in one eye. I seemed to have bitten my tongue and chipped a tooth. I could cope with all of that, and would have to, immediately. Before moving, though, I scrolled through the medical diagnostic options and authorized my suit to do whatever was required to make me functional. Micro-syringes pricked my skin around the damaged joints, and pumped a cocktail of steroids, anti-inflammatories, and localized painkillers into the affected regions. I soon felt a warm numbness around my hips and knees. As awkward and uncoordinated as it made me feel, it allowed me to begin the work ahead. Groaning against the pain of my ribs, there was nothing the suit could do for me there, I cracked open the dropship's hull and wriggled out of its close-fitting compartment. Somewhat unsteadily, I stood up and moved around the wreckage. Lying there on the ground, still smoking, the dropship looked far too small to have contained me, let alone to have been my home for the 3 months it had taken to reach Mars. Heat-proof compartments had been built into its skin for equipment too bulky to be stowed inside, along with my suit. I kicked at these scorched hatches until they sprang open, then collected the items stored inside. I fixed them onto the many attachment points on my suit. Survival rations, medical supplies, small arms, ammunition, and one heavy machine gun, which I stowed on a specially engineered rig across my lower back, beneath my rear life support pack. I checked the dropship over one final time, making sure I had left nothing, then sent the verbal command that instructed it to self-bury. Parts of its hull moved counter to each other in a complex, spiraling pattern, cutting surfaces digging into the ground and slowly gaining traction. It looked like a dark, squirming maggot. I stood back and watched for the 5 minutes it took the dropship to fully submerge itself. It would keep going down until it hit bedrock, and then begin an even slower process of autocatalytic breakdown, denying the conjoiners any useful components or materials, if they were ever lucky enough to find the burial spot. I scuffed over the disturbed ground with my heel. The surface disturbance was actually quite minor. Winds were due in a few days, and would soon conceal evidence of the burial. In the meantime, it would simply look like the impact point of a piece of debris from the asteroid. Exactly as planned. Footprints were more of a problem. Each of us had to cross hundreds of kilometers to the rendezvous point, and still more to the capsule. Fortunately, the mission planners had considered this detail. My suit had thickened bulges around its ankles and sleeves. These were a mission-specific augmentation, containing telescopic stilts. I deployed the ankle stilts a step at a time, teetering on my rising height, until they were at their maximum extension. After a few seconds of unsteadiness, my balance came back. We had trained well enough that using the legs was mostly second nature. The sleeve-mounted stilts were reserved for scrambling over difficult terrain, and I would not need them immediately. The stilts had been carefully engineered to leave the minimum possible ground disturbance, while just supporting my weight. They were also made of a strong thermal insulator, so that we minimized our heat transfer to the terrain, critical, as we would need to keep moving in the hours of darkness. The final adaptation to the suit was a huge self-deploying camouflage parasol. It popped out of a compartment in the top of my backpack, pushed up on a stalk above my head, then flung out overlapping segments to an adjustable radius of up to 3 meters. The parasol had a domed profile, so that its edges drooped to within about a meter of the surface. It obstructed my sightline, but the parasol was sewn with arrays of sensors which fed a visual overlay to my visor. In an emergency, I could squat low, blending with the ground under total concealment. The parasol's upper surface was constantly adjusting itself to achieve a seamless match of color, texture, and temperature with the ground underneath it. It was a lot of trouble to go to, given that the conjoiners had little opportunity for overhead surveillance. But its main purpose was to deceive the neutral demarchists into believing that the Coalition was still fully compliant with its treaties. I moved off, making 4 meter strides with each swing of my stilts. There was no transition, no easy build-up. I was immediately into my rhythm, moving at the unforgiving pace we had trained for. Through the numbing fog of the drugs, I still felt the protestation of my joints and muscles. If it became unbearable, the suit could increase its anesthetic dosage. But one thing I could not do, would not permit myself to do, was to slow or to stop. A pulse on my faceplate showed the direction I needed to go, and the estimated distance to the rendezvous point. 600 kilometers. Under training conditions, I had averaged 200 kilometers a day, if the terrain was not too treacherous. 3 days continual movement, without rest. Undaunted, emptying my mind of all thoughts except the need to make the next stride, I strode on. Neville would not thank any of us for delaying his escape, least of all me. The ship ushered me to the control room without delay. Before I took my seat, the false windows were already giving me a good idea of our position. An ochre haze arced away from the ship to port and starboard, darkening to black overhead. I could see a few stars, and maybe a few dull moving glints from whatever was left of the rust belt, but we were not yet in space. There had been ample time, though, given the time I had been with Glass, so Scythe must have been delaying its exit for a reason. The only one I could think of was that it was already considered too dangerous for us to lose the relative cover of the atmosphere. "Ship," I said, buckling myself in. "Glass says that you'll accept my commands up to a point. Put me in contact with Lady Arryk, as securely as you can manage." Lady Arryk's voice emerged from the console a moment later. "Hourglass? No, it's me. Glass is out of action for the time being. How much do you know?" "Almost nothing. We have our own situation out here, and it is not improving. Glass is hurt. What about you and Pinky?" "We're both all right. Both safe on the ship, and clear of Chasm City. The Nine Cats turned on Glass, but she says the ship can help her recover from her injuries. Is it safe to remain in communication?" "You will know the moment it isn't." I studied the location fix, by which the laser was maintaining its lock on Lady Arryk's ship. Her position was a few hundred kilometers higher than my own, well out of the atmosphere, and moving so as to blend in with the flow of debris around the planet. But she was not on any sort of trajectory that would bring her back to the stronghold. "We have a complication, Lady Arryk. I don't know how much Glass or the ship communicated to you, but we're carrying hyper-pig evacuees from the swine house."
"How many?"
"I haven't done a head count. Around 100, I'd guess. Maybe a few more."
"What are your intentions with them?"
"I don't have any. Glass rescued them without telling us. Can the stronghold make room for them until we come up with something better?" I felt as if I was talking into a void. "Lady Arryk." Her voice sounded broken, drained of the last drop of hope.
"It's finished. The wolves have identified it as a source of organized human activity, and now they're massing. The defenses have been activated, but the best they can manage is a delaying action. I've aborted my return. The only safe action now is to dock with Scythe and exchange the Gideon stones. What about the people still there? I am afraid there is no way out for them. They know this, Clavain. They are as resigned to it as I am. We can't just give in, I protested. We're not giving in. There was a fierce rebuttal in her words. We have the stones, all nine. I brought the single stone with us in case a comparison was needed. Now all we need is to arrange a rendezvous for which the destruction of the stronghold will provide a useful distraction. Lady Arryk was silent for a moment. I imagine you think that I take this all a little coldly. You underestimate me. I've thought this through 1,000 times, considered every possible response, every possible get-out clause. Nothing works. The only good outcome we can achieve today is not dying. Are you intending to die, Warren Clavain? Of course not. Then here are my instructions. Follow them. I told the ship to instigate my orders in 5 minutes, which gave me time to get back down to Pinky and the refugees. Did you see Glass? Yes, and I think she'll be all right, once she's spent some time in the infirmary. For now, we're on our own, though. I've spoken to Lady Arryk. Our best course of action lies in an immediate rendezvous with her ship. Why don't we wait until we're safe inside the stronghold? It's tactically inadvisable. Why? I nodded out over the heads of the refugees, recognizing the most prominent of them and making mental notes of some of the others, and speaking to all of them. In a few minutes, we're going to accelerate hard. If I know the ship, then it will orientate its interior surfaces to minimize the risk of injury. But that doesn't mean it won't be hard. Spread yourself out as best you can and get as low to the floor as possible. If you have clothing or other items that can serve as cushioning, use it. Do what you can for the injured and infirm. The acceleration won't last long, after which we'll be weightless. That carries its own hazards, of course. Do not allow yourselves to drift too far from any surface, in case the ship needs to make a sudden course change. I raised my hand slowly, as if in surrender. I wish this wasn't the welcome, but for the moment, it's all we can offer. In about 2 hours, we make rendezvous with another ship. If that goes well, we can begin to talk about the future. But for now, concentrate on getting through these next 2 hours.
Something's not going to plan, said the hyperpig called Barris.
We're in the woods, I said, but there's a way out, provided we make the right decisions. I made a lowering gesture with my hands, encouraging them to get down on the floor. In ones and twos, they began to comply, until Barris spoke up and made them scramble for a patch of floor. Quickly, the pigs rummaged around among their rags, plumping up anything that would offer a degree of cushioning. You too, Pinky, I said, lowering myself as well. We'll ride this out down here. The ship knows what it needs to do. He settled next to me, both of us picking a spot of floor space on the edge of the refugees, but not separated from them. In a low, gruff tone, he said, You didn't answer my question. I looked down at my folded legs. There's a reason for that. How bad is it? Bad enough that there are things Lady Arryk would rather you heard from her lips. Then whatever promise you made to her, you've already half broken it. Actually, I think I may have broken all of it. Then you might as well tell me whatever it is she doesn't think I need to know right now. I felt as if I was sitting next to a bomb and had just begun to play with a naked flame. I wondered about the rage that might be in him and the imperfect control he had over that rage. Perhaps Lady Arryk had only ever been trying to spare me as the bringer of bad news. Perhaps she knew what he was capable of doing to me. We can't go back. Can't or shouldn't. The wolves are already there. His next question was all the more unsettling for its calm reasonableness. It only made me wonder what was being bottled up under steadily rising pressure. Snowdrop and the others are gone. Lady Arryk says they're putting up a defense. They know it won't make a difference. Once a wolf agglomeration locks on in force, it's only a matter of time. He settled on his haunches. Squat-trunked and bow-legged as he was, he seemed more comfortable on the floor than I did. They know it's futile. They could end it in a second by overloading the stronghold's reactors. But they won't, I answered, because they want to give us a chance. While they can provide a distraction, the wolves won't necessarily pick up on our ships. Is Lady Arryk in contact with Snowdrop, or inferring this from long-range observations? She didn't say. I'd like to know. I had not been keeping a mental count, but the 5 minutes must have expired because the acceleration began to rise. It was a gradual shift to begin with, and I was relieved to find that my sense of vertical did not begin to wander. The ship was pressing us against the floor, but at least we were not being dashed against the walls, buried in a suffocating, bone-shattering pile. Groans and cries came from the refugees, and I imagined some of them were having old or recent injuries put under unpleasant stress. But if they could get through these next 2 minutes, I might at least be able to keep them alive for another 2 hours. There's something else we need to discuss, I said quietly.
Now that we've got that small business of the death of my partner and most of my community out the way, you mean?
I don't mean that. Once we're weightless, we'll go forward and see if we can re-establish contact with Lady Arryk. But there's a snag with this plan. You and I will be all right. There are acceleration couches in the control room. Glass will be all right as well. She's in some kind of suspension bottle. But everyone else will need to be prepared for 10 G's of deceleration. Pinky lifted his head against the strain of 2 additional gravities and glanced out at the refugees. A snag, you call it. There was no other way that made this feasible. The one saving grace is that it won't be for long. He regarded me for a long moment, then nodded. You looked at the other options.
Yes,
and they were all significantly worse. And when we get the Gideon stones, what then?
Glass said something about Ararat. Not the first time it's come up, either.
Have you been to Ararat's stink?
No. Is there a reason I should have? He chose his answer carefully.
It's an interesting place.
You'd know? We were all there. Me, Lady Arryk, the old man, lived there a while. Bad things happened on Ararat and then we left. Part of me would be very happy never to have to go back. Part of you? Actually, make that all of me.
By the time Scythe shrugged itself clear of Yellowstone's atmosphere, it was already moving ballistically, with just enough excess speed to intersect Lady Arryk's orbit. The pigs took to weightlessness quite well to begin with, even after all they had been through. It was a pleasant novelty to experience for the first time. But I knew very well that a host of unpleasant side effects were likely to come their way shortly, and few, if any of them, would be prepared. The air circulators were going to be dealing with a lot more than just gaseous waste products, so I hoped Glass had insisted on ample redundancy. Pinky took to the weightlessness with no difficulty. Between us, we made quick progress back up to the control room, with me mentally counting down the minutes until we would need a system in place to safeguard the refugees. Pinky and I agreed that we would coordinate our tasks in tandem. He would signal Lady Arryk, getting clarification on the situation at the stronghold, and I would try to persuade the ship that it needed to provide protection for the new passengers. If all else failed, I was counting on Glass still being this side of consciousness so that she could instruct the ship directly. But I was starting to worry that she had already withdrawn into herself. You can tell Lady Arryk we're on our way, I said to Pinky, once I had instructed the ship to open a channel for him. Our estimated time of arrival will be 109 minutes from now. In all likelihood, she won't see any trace of us until we're right on top of her and slowing down hard, so warn her to stand down any anti-ship weapons she might have armed. Worried she'll hurt us? More worried what Scythe might do in return. Pinky and Lady Arryk communicated, and although my attention was on the task of making arrangements for the refugees,
I still caught most of the exchange. For two old allies, two old friends, as far as I could tell, it was not far off a screaming argument. Lady Arryk was furious with me for telling Pinky what was happening to the stronghold. Pinky was furious with Lady Arryk for presuming to think that he would not be level-headed enough to process this news like a rational being. Lady Arryk in turn was furious at him for having the temerity to presume upon the wisdom of her reticence, and to dare to suggest that it was rooted in anything other than kind concern and a deep-seated understanding of the extremes he might go to in the service of a lost cause. "You are the bravest of all of us," she was shouting, "the one who only today offered up his life for the greater cause of our struggle. But then there was a chance, a shred of hope, just enough reason to believe. With the stronghold, we are far past that point. Nothing can be done, nothing at all, and I will not risk the life of my dearest friend twice in one day." "How dare you call me brave, and then keep this from me, while telling him? He needed to know that the stronghold was not a viable destination," she replied, her voice breaking on her fury. And so it went, while I kept on trying to find some way of alerting the ship that it needed to take care of its own. Perhaps my message had got through, perhaps it had not. There was no way to tell. Gradually the shouting and screaming gave way to something loosely resembling reasoned dialogue, and after some deliberation, Lady Arryk was persuaded to share the intelligence she was gathering from the stronghold. We only got a small part of it, since the data had to be compressed to the point where it could share the voice-only laser link without degrading the signal. It was enough. From what we were shown, it was clear that we had no hope of rescuing Snowdrop and the others. The stronghold was still intact, but it was wreathed in a thickening cloud of black machines, partially or totally obscuring the view of it from the monitoring eyes Lady Arryk had sprinkled around the rust belt. The wolves were concentrating in shell-like waves, clotting around the little asteroid and then falling inward. Where the view was clearest, we could see that the stronghold was fighting back, with bursts of energy stabbing out from dozens of previously concealed weapons emplacements. I felt for the burden of decision that must have befallen Snowdrop as she committed to those defenses. They were only ever going to be capable of staving off the wolves for a limited time, and in deploying them, they removed any doubt that there were humans still around Yellowstone. Humans with potent machines and a will to survive. Snowdrop had probably been condemned from the moment the wolves took any sort of exceptional interest in the stronghold. In discharging the defenses, she had as good as signed her own death warrant. But the wolves were not getting their prize for free. Snowdrop's weapons were formidable, and I took some small solace in the way they blasted holes through those curdling shells, annihilating or dispersing wolf elements as if they were no more than buzzing black flies. The shells became ragged, lacy and discontinuous, and then broke apart completely. But there were always more shells forming, like distant breakers marshalling for a charge against the shoreline. Wolf flows were funneling in from multiple points around the rust belt, providing a near-limitless reservoir of reinforcements. As always with the wolves, they would accept surprisingly heavy losses in the early stages of an engagement while they probed and learned and adapted. Sooner or later, the units would coordinate a modification to their force-generating mechanisms, either by rapid evolution or by dredging some proven response from their archives of prior encounters. They had workable countermeasures for every weapon we had ever invented, as well as the equivalent efforts of all the other species they had acted against. It was only ever a question of time before they found the right way to overcome Snowdrop, and in the meantime, some losses were not only acceptable, but perfectly unconcerning to them. These were not soldiers, but elements of a single vast war machine, operating on a scale of light years and a timescale of centuries. What hope had we of defeating such a thing? None at all, I thought to myself. To think anything else was species-level hubris. But there might be other survival strategies. If we could force the wolves to a negotiated standoff, a point where they recognized that we were too much trouble to annihilate completely, but could be contained, that would count nearly as well as victory. The wolves' greatest strength was their patience, their willingness to sit out an enemy for millions of years. If we put up a sufficiently messy, obstinate struggle, they might move us into a holding category, a problem to be deferred for a galactic rotation or two. To the wolves, that would not count as defeat in any sense, merely a drawing of breath. But we were warm, fleet creatures who operated on timescales utterly beneath their comprehension. A mayfly would regard an extra hour as a welcome stay of execution. We had to think like mayflies. "Put me through," Pinky said.
"No,"
Lady Arik answered. "I can't risk it. I've had no direct contact with Snowdrop for 40 minutes. There's too high a chance of wolf interception."
"Do it anyway."
"Dear Scorpio."
Her voice broke on the name that came most naturally to her, the name he no longer wished to carry.
"Dear friend."
"Do it," I said, speaking up. "I have a message for Snowdrop as well." There was a silence, broken only by the occasional static crackle as the weapons' discharges burst into our comms circuits.
"I've opened the link. Voice only, and no guarantee that it'll hold. Snowdrop and I have already made our farewells."
"Then this is mine," I said. "Snowdrop, I hope you can hear me. I see what you're doing, and it's magnificent. It will fail, as you know it will fail, but your brave actions will have bought us the time and the distraction we need. For that, I thank you." Her voice came through, a thinned, metallic approximation of the real thing. I might not have recognized it had I not already spent time with her.
"Don't feel sorry for me. Every hour that I haven't been trapped in Swinehouse is an hour I never expected to live. The others feel the same way. We have always been ready for this. Make that exchange count. Will you do one thing for me?"
"I'll try."
"Accept your true name. Glass went to a lot of trouble to find you. We were all counting on her to succeed. Now she's brought you to us. You have to accept what you are. Promise me you will do this."
My voice faltered. "I can't promise what I don't believe in."
"But you will, in time. So make that adjustment. No one's asking you to forsake the memories of who you thought you were before Glass arrived. I know you had family, and she ripped them away. I'm sorry about that, Warren, but it was all only scar tissue. Become the man we need you to be. You are Sky Marshal Warren Clavaine, a Knight of Cydonia."
I intoned the words she wished me to say. "I am Sky Marshal Warren Clavaine."
"Now say it like you mean it."
"I am Sky Marshal Warren Clavaine," I said more forcefully.
"Shout it, soldier! Tell the world who you are!"
I raged. "I am Sky Marshal Warren Clavaine,
and the rest, a Knight of Cydonia. Good. Good."
Snowdrop became quieter, seemingly satisfied.
"That's better. Deep down, you already know. Avenge us, Sky Marshal. You have the Gideon Stone. Now slay some wolves."
"Goodbye, Snowdrop," I said.
"Goodbye, Sky Marshal. And now, could I speak to Pinky, please? We've a few things to say to each other. All of them private."
Chapter 18. The pigs were in a state of consternation, which had nothing to do with our impending arrival at Lady Arik's ship. They were already being dealt with by Scythe. Dozens of sphere robots had bustled out of somewhere. I had only ever seen a few of them at a time before, and were now encouraging, or in some cases forcing, the refugees to adopt fixed postures with their backs to the floor. Once they obeyed, the area of floor beneath them puckered in, as if it were made of rubber, forming a partial enclosure around the recumbent form. The floor did not close over completely. It left a snug opening so that the occupant could still breathe and communicate. But in all other senses, they were totally imprisoned by the floor, unable to move their limbs or in any way free themselves. I understood instantly. The ship was making provision for the deceleration burst. But to the refugees, it was as if they were being forcibly absorbed into the floor like so many trophies. Some, including Barras, were trying to impose some kind of calm, insisting that this had to be part of some plan for their protection. But for too many of the refugees, the whole experience must have brought back sharp memories of imprisonment and torture in the swine house. The worst of the resistors were being pinned in place by the spheres, literally pressed into the yielding floor until the floor swaddled itself around their forms and stopped them thrashing. Barras was one of the ones not yet interred.
"Tell me this is for our benefit?"
"It will be," I said, equally astonished and enraged that the ship had not thought fit to tell me that my concerns had been noted and acted upon. "When this weightless phase is over, which will be in about 80 minutes, Scythe will have to break very hard. If you were left to float around, I don't think many of you would survive the process. This way it will be uncomfortable, but survivable."
"Some of us only just made it through the last one."
"I know, and this will be worse. I'm sorry, Barras." I looked out among the confusion of refugees and sphere robots, a storm of rags and scraps littering the air as the unwilling patients resisted their fates. "It will be all right. Can you give them my word that this isn't anything bad, and they'll be let out of the floor once our maneuvers are complete?" Barras eyed me quizzically.
"You know that, for a fact?"
"I don't, but everything I've seen so far suggests to me that this ship wants to protect its occupants, including you."
"They'd feel better if that reassurance came from Pinky."
I wondered how much of the truth to share with him, then decided that any trust was better consolidated by absolute openness, no matter how unpalatable the news. "Snowdrop is going to die, Barras. The wolves have hit Lady Arryk's stronghold. There are a few folk still inside, and they're using whatever weapons they have to delay the wolf incursion. Ultimately, none of what they have will work, but that delaying action helps us." Barras absorbed what I had said. I hardly dared wonder about the shared history that existed between this man, Snowdrop, and Pinky. It was none of my business, and yet I still sensed the edge of something as harrowing and wonderful as any human story of friendship and resilience. They did not have to be human to be people. All had been through far more than I could imagine, far more than I wished to imagine.
"Is he with her now?"
"Some final words," I said softly. Lady Arryk was against establishing a link, but we persuaded her. Barras met my eyes, a mutual understanding passing between us.
"Some things matter too much. After what Pinky went through in the swine house, this doesn't seem fair."
"Nothing is. Cold as it seems, that's probably the safest philosophy to live by."
"I'll tell them there's nothing to fear,"
Barras said, looking doubtfully out at the unruly chaos of pigs, shredded clothing, and dogged, kindly robots trying to do their best.
"And I hope I don't live to regret that promise."
"Thank you." Before he turned to the others, he had one last question for me.
"There is a plan, isn't there? I mean, if we can't go back to the stronghold, then I don't suppose there's any safety to be found in the Rust Belt at all. That means we have to live somewhere else."
He paused and repeated himself, this time with a more plaintive note.
"There is a plan?"
"There will be," I said. The comms had ceased. Lady Arryk's surveillance assets had gone dark across the Rust Belt. Flares garlanded Yellowstone as the wolves turned against the largest of the surviving structures. In some cases, there was still enough air inside them for fires to burn. Nothing diverted Scythe or caused it to recalculate its approach. It was only quite near the end, in the last minutes of our flight, that we had verification that we were closing in on the right object, a speck of debris that was a little warmer than its neighbors, but not so much that it stood out across thousands of kilometers. Then our dark drives went into emergency reverse thrust, 10 G's of sudden deceleration, and instead of whipping right past our objective, we were on it, coming to a bruising but precise standstill only 20 meters from Lady Arryk. After that, everything happened very quickly. Scythe had already modelled the optimum approach for docking, and we orientated and latched on with indecent, hull-clanging haste. It helped that Glass and Lady Arryk had already agreed and coordinated a common lock interface, so there was no need for Scythe to go through the troubling business of adapting itself to the other, slower-witted spacecraft. Just as swiftly, Lady Arryk and probably Rose came aboard with the Gideon Stones, as well as several cases of supplies and weapons. We were nearly ready to detach. Almost certainly the wolves had picked up on something happening here, for that 10G slowdown had forced the dark drives to operate at a level where their reaction products lingered in this universe a little longer than otherwise. "We will speak of what you went through later," Lady Arryk said, hugging Pinky. "Never think for a second that this debt will be forgotten."
"It's nothing compared to what we owe Snowdrop and the others."
He eased himself from her embrace.
"You did all right, Rash. So did Stinky."
"You think he might be cut from the old cloth, after all?"
"Jury's still deliberating. But he didn't let us down."
"I must look at your injuries, Clavain, yes,"
probably Rose said, eyeing where I had been shot.
"What am I? Pork?" Pinky asked.
"You are made of injuries. If I treated one, I'd have to treat them all. And then, where would it end?"
"Fair point," the pig acknowledged.
"Besides," probably Rose went on, "you are not the one who was shot. Have you recovered from the hemoclast?"
"I'm all right," I admitted.
Lady Arryk's aim was true, and the suits flushed the hemoclast out of us while we were still on Yellowstone.
"Was it as bad as they say?"
"No, much worse.
But I'm feeling much better with my own blood back in me, and my wounds have been fixed up well enough. This leg of mine can wait for the time being. Somewhere in here is an exoskeleton Glass provided me for when we were leaving Sun Hollow. If I can find it again, I won't need to put any load on my leg."
"If you find it, see if you can find some others,"
Lady Arryk said. "We may all have need before very long."
"Probably, Rose. Can you see what can be done for the evacuees?"
Probably Rose steeled herself for work.
"Show me to them, and send medical servitors and supplies, yes."
Lady Arryk turned to me.
"Is there any word on Hourglass?"
I found her floating in a bottle, about to be put into a medical coma. A sharp shake of her head.
"Now is not the time for her to abdicate control of this ship.
I don't think she likes it either, but it's what needs to be done. Glass will come back to us when she can. Until then, we're on our own. But the ship will oblige, I think, especially if we can help it understand our requirements." I nodded over her shoulder, into the still open lock. "Is there anything else inside that shuttle that we need to unload?"
"All essential items have already come aboard."
"Then we'd better close up and we'll be underway," I said, wondering why Amori was taking so long to leave the shuttle.
"There's a difficulty,"
Lady Arryk said, looking back over her shoulder to the airlock, where our two ships were still mated.
"We took some incoming fire from the swine house after I sent you that signal. Amori had to fly her out on manual control, and now she won't accept our commands to go away."
"Then we abandon that part of the plan and make a run for it anyway. If the wolves converge on this point in space, they'll find a drifting shuttle and assume that was the source of the emissions." Lady Arryk turned back again.
"Amore, we shall think of something else."
Then, to me, "I will audit the systems as soon as I can. But in the meantime, you can help me.
Does this vehicle still have drone missiles, the ones Hourglass uses for reconnaissance?"
"I think so," I said, unwilling to commit to an answer, since the control of those missiles was another question entirely. "I suppose we could attach one of them to the shuttle, boost it that way. As long as it made enough noise and light, it would serve." I trailed off, realizing what was happening in the same instant as Lady Arryk. Amori had closed the airlock connection from the shuttle side and was already initiating a forced undocking, severing our two ships. Lady Arryk hammered on the now sealed lock.
"Amori, no! You do not need to do this!"
But Amori was doing it anyway. The shuttle detached from Scythe. We watched it through the false windows either side of the lock, easing away from us on attitude jets until Amori had created enough of a safe margin to engage the engines. The shuttle corkscrewed, then dashed away on an arcing trajectory. I watched it numbly, aware of the sacrifice I had just witnessed, unable to comprehend how it must have felt to Lady Arryk. She seemed paralyzed, stunned into inaction. I was about to suggest that we would be wasting Amori's sacrifice unless we moved immediately, but I had gravely underestimated her.
"He has made his choice, and there is nothing I can do about it," she stated. "Now we had better make it count. There's nowhere safe for us in this system. Nothing to delay our departure for Ararat. We'll need to run the dark drives to the limit of detection, but not one thrust increment beyond that threshold."
"The ship should understand," I said. "The deeper question is whether it can keep all of us alive. I only saw 2 reef-asleep caskets."
"Then it will need to make more. I imagine that will be comfortably within its capabilities."
"Aren't you taking rather a lot on faith?" She looked at me patiently.
"Let me explain something about survival. You do not worry about the 3rd or 4th stepping stone until you have successfully traversed the 1st and 2nd. Anything beyond them is a diversion of energies away from the immediate moment, and we are in that moment now."
I smiled, accepting my lesson. "Rash. Lady Aura Rashmika Elskore," Pinky said. "Arryk is much less of a mouthful."
"Show me to the injured," Probably Rose requested.
We fled. The wolf concentration around Lady Arryk's former stronghold was a thick black coating now, the machines pressing in on each other like demented puzzle pieces, locking into some secret configuration. They jostled and surged, settling into denser and denser formations, even as more machines arrived from around the Rust Belt, converging along sooty flows that we only saw because they blocked all forms of light. Lady Arryk's weapons had either expired or were no longer capable of blasting through any part of that screen. We had to assume the worst, that the inner layer of machines would shortly penetrate the locks and passages that led into the habitable parts of the stronghold, or simply grind their way through rock and rubble until they reached the same objective. No signals were now possible between us, and perhaps that was a mercy. There was nothing we could do for them, and no news they could offer us that would not have been harrowing. It was conceivable, likely even, that Snowdrop and her associates were already dead, and all that remained was the last dogged defiance of a few housekeeping programs. But the reactors had not blown, to the best of our knowledge. Nor had wolves yet caught up with Amori. But they were on their way. We could detect subflows breaking away from the main movement within the Rust Belt, being assigned to this new target. From 4 points, spaced around Yellowstone at roughly equal divisions, black wisps were fingering in the direction of the shuttle. They were not wasting energy moving any faster than they needed to. That, I think, was the most terrifying thing of all, that this alien killing system knew that it did not need to be hasty, not against such trifling creatures as ourselves. It would get us in the end. I was a soldier. I accepted this now. It was in my marrow, no longer to be denied. Every soldierly part of me wanted to take the fight directly to the wolves, to unpick that black scab, to slash at those reaching fingers before they found their objective. But a cooler part of me, born of experience and survival, the wiser, older warrior, knew that we take our victories where we find them, and accept our defeats with grace and patience. Stepping stones. While Probably Rose was down with the evacuees, doing what she could with her own medical supplies, Lady Arryk, Pinky, and I watched the end of things from the control room. Scythe was flying away from the Rust Belt, with its nose pointed towards interstellar space, so the view through the false windows ought to have been one of blackness and stars. But Lady Arryk had found a way to have the window show the view to our stern, of the receding Rust Belt and the planet it orbited. Our acceleration soon had Yellowstone looking visibly smaller, with a larger and larger fraction of the Rust Belt coming into view, until we could see all of it, from one side of the orbit to the other. Yellowstone's face was lit, So the part of the rust belt that bisected the planet was a sooty ribbon, a smear of ash across the brow. No intact structures could be made out within that procession now. It was a flow of ruins, the shards of worlds, dust-wreathed and dream-haunted. It was where humans had tried to be more than themselves, for a few short centuries. We had seen it on our approach, and it was different now. The wolf flows were dark arteries, curling and spiraling through these broken pieces, throbbing out to the largest remnants, where the machines had gorged and multiplied and waited until their time of release and quickening. Where the rust belt lay against a background of space, on either side of the planet, it should have been as invisible as it had been before, its presence betrayed only by the stars it occluded. But now flecks of gold and red burned like lanterns on a slow-flowing river. These were the last human fires, the last gasps of life and oxygen, as tiny warm pockets were at last evacuated to space.
"It's beautiful again," Lady Arryk said. "After all this, it gets to be beautiful again. Just for a few hours, on this last day."
"We precipitated this," I said. "Our arrival, Glass and me. If we hadn't come, this wouldn't have happened."
"Maybe not today, but soon enough," she replied.
"We were here because the wolves came for us in the first place, and the only reason they did that is because some misguided fish once decided to try breathing oxygen instead of water." "She does this," Pinky said. "Just when you think you're consequential, she finds a way to bring you down to the level of a fish." He shrugged, shoulders powerful even in 3Gs. He had buckled on an exoskeleton, helpfully finding one that was adjustable to his frame. He was so short, squat, stocky, and muscular that I wondered if he needed its assistance at all. "Still, at least she stopped at something with a nervous system. She's been known to go all the way down to bacteria." He was distracting himself. A moment later, a pinprick of light stabbed out from one quadrant of the rust belt. It was like a little eye, winking open, an eye that disclosed a brighter, purer creation beyond itself. It stared out for a second or two. Then the eye shuttered, the light extinguished. Pinky was silent. I wanted to say something, to offer some consolation, but any words that came to mind were immediately self-censored, unforgivably trite and demeaning.
"We thank her,"
Lady Arryk said, "Snowdrop and the others.
That's all. We thank them and keep thanking them while we have breath to do so. There's nothing we can do except to live and keep living and always hold that gratitude in our hearts."
She reached out to her friend, the Hyperpig, the man I hoped might, in time, become my own friend as well.
"And be consequential."
When we were alone, a stoic, brooding Pinky had waddled off in his exoskeleton to see probably Rose, Barris, and the other evacuees. Lady Arryk called an image onto one of the screens, drawn from deep in Scythe's archives.
"Hourglass would have shown this to you sooner or later, or you would have found a way to extract it via your own inquiries, but it's as well that you see it now, and understand."
I felt as if I were being set a test, that I was already in the process of failing. The image was a square bisected along a very shallow curve, practically a straight diagonal. The upper left half was black, a backdrop of space, with only a few faint stars speckling into view. The lower right half of the image was a close-up of part of a planet, with the curved limb forming the boundary between the darker and lighter parts of the image. The visible part of the planet was a pale blue in colour, but with bands and swirls of deeper colour, shading to opal and turquoise.
"I don't recognise it." "I did not expect you to. What does that begin to tell you?"
"I suppose it must be Charybdis, the place Glass has been dropping hints about since we met. She told me that she was the one who applied the name, and that it isn't so far away as to be beyond the reach of a ship like Scythe. From that view, I'd say it's an ice giant, something fairly common. We'd need to cross-correlate against the known systems."
"You are right that ice giants are commonplace,
but this planet matches none in any of the systems that have been subjected to any kind of robotic or human exploration. That is our difficulty, Clavain. Tell me, if I asked you to localize this planet, what would you do next?
Zoom out, so that more stars fall into view. It should be child's play to back compute the star patterns and identify which system the planet's in.
A valid suggestion. Unfortunately, what you are seeing is the extent of the image, and the handful of stars that happened to be recorded offer an insufficient baseline for parallactic triangulation. All other image localization measures have failed. The brightness of the galactic ridge, the anisotropy of the background radiation, none give us enough leverage. From the spectrum of light falling onto Charybdis, we may hazard that its primary is a G-type star, perhaps a G0 dwarf, but that barely begins to help us. We cannot determine the system in which this planet lies.
This doesn't make sense, Lady Arryk. If you have one snapshot, you should have a billion. Whether someone captured this view through a telescope from light years away, or from much closer in, it would never be the only thing you have.
In this instance, regrettably, it is. Let me explain.
Please do.
I misled you slightly. This system has been visited, but it was an undocumented visitation centuries ago by an early interstellar expedition sent out by the conjoiners. Specifically, this image was recorded by the Sandra Voy, the prototype starship assembled and launched under the aegis of Galiana.
The Galiana.
One and the same. In the early decades of the 23rd century, Galiana and her doughty band of allies pushed deep into interstellar space, looking for sanctuary, and for anything else that pricked their limitless curiosity. They came home, eventually. In time, their discoveries entered the conjoiner archives, but those archives were very badly corrupted during subsequent troubles. Much was lost, or scrambled beyond recognition, including the data logs relating to this system. Only fragments remained legible. Among them was enough information to indicate the significance of Charybdis to the anti-wolf effort, but not enough to help us determine how to find the planet itself. Of course, it is a cold gas giant, and while they are numerous, there must be a fixed limit to the number of systems and worlds that the Sandra Voy could possibly have reached, allowing for relativistic mechanics. So, if our time and resources were limitless, we could simply send autonomous expeditions to every possible system of interest, out to at least 50 or 60 light-years from Earth. That is a great many systems, Clavain, many thousands, and these are not normal times. Even if we restricted our search space to G-types, the task facing us would still be formidable. The wolves stalk us at every step, as we see. We cannot solve this problem by blunt means.
She paused.
Hence, you.
I blinked. Neville Clavain was closely involved with Galiana. They were enemies once, I know that much. Then something happened to turn him to her cause. He defected from his own side and threw his lot in with the conjoiners. When she did not contradict me, I ventured further. To the extent that he was on that expedition, I suppose.
He was.
And we know that Neville Clavain must have died with the knowledge we need. He would have remembered Charybdis as an anomaly, something worthy of further investigation, and he would have known the system in which it lies.
Then, you're hoping that by some osmosis, his dying knowledge will have seeped into my brain as well? Just because I'm his long-lost brother?
No, we are not fools, Warren.
Ararat is the key, because Clavain died there. Normally that would be the end of it, except for one thing. Ararat is an ocean planet, a pattern juggler's world. It is believed by us that Clavain's memory patterns remain encoded and retrievable through the pattern jugglers.
I know something of how it works with the jugglers, I admitted. If they have preserved his personality, and there's no promise of that,
Someone else might be able to swim in the same seas and have his patterns imprinted into their own neural matrix. If the jugglers are willing, and they understand the request. Has one of you already tried it? I detected some diffidence in Lady Arryk, there and gone in a flash. Hourglass, indeed, attempted communion in the manner you allude to. It was not successful. There would be a much greater likelihood of success if someone with a personal connection to Neville Clavaine were to meet the jugglers. I see. I reflected on her answer, feeling that something larger and more obvious lay just out of reach. I'm guessing her contact attempt wasn't totally unsuccessful. Clearly she reached enough of Neville to gain some insight into my part in all this.
Your part?
That I existed, that I might be able to stand in for Neville, to some extent, that I could be found on Sun Hollow. But a small doubtful voice whispered to me that my brother could never have known of my intentions to take the Salmasis to AU Microscopii. Our paths had diverged after Mars. He might have hated me in the aftermath of that betrayal, but the years would surely have pushed my memory to the back of his mind, along with all the trappings of his younger days. He had concerned himself with bigger matters than brotherly spite. The fate not just of one ideology, but human civilization itself. There was no reason at all that I should have crossed his thoughts in the last years of his life, and even less reason for me to have mattered to some ghost of him, haunting an alien ocean. Then again, my brother had never been one to forget a slight. Lady Arryk prompted gently, "Warren, I was just wondering what it would take from me. It will not be so onerous. You will swim with them, something millions have done before. There's little risk in that alone. You may be rebuffed before the opening of any window of contact, but if that happens you will survive and we will regroup and make another attempt. Eventually there will be an opportunity for communion. After that, it is just a question of intent and the holding in mind of a clear objective. If you open your mind to the jugglers, if you submit to them that you are the brother of one who lies within them, there is every chance that they will facilitate the transfer of recorded knowledge. Your mind, and that of Neville's, will not be so very different. Your neural matrix will accept his, an augmentation of your personality rather than an erasure. It must and will succeed. You are by far the best receptacle we could hope to find. And after this is done, if it's possible, it's your expectation that I'll magically remember everything you need to know about Charybdis? It is not a question of magic, merely one of alien biology. But you see that our hopes must be pinned on the jugglers. However we calculate the odds, they improve with your involvement. I tasted salty water, felt the sting of green sunlight on my eyes. A sudden panic of drowning rose in my chest. Why am I frightened, Lady Arryk? Why do I feel like I've already been to the pattern jugglers, already tried this thing you want me to do, and that it didn't end well?
You would remember if you had visited them, Lady Arryk answered.
Then, consolingly,
don't dwell on it, Warren. It is what lies ahead of us that we must be concerned by, not imagined phantoms. The unknown is always troubling.
I knew his name, I whispered.
His name?
Scorpio, or Scorp, as his friends called him, as I think Neville called him. It slipped out of me without thinking. I looked at her with renewed intensity. How could I ever know that?
I must have used his old name in a moment of indiscretion, and you overheard it without realizing.
Sensing an impasse, I returned my attention to the cryptic image fragment, wondering how it had come into our possession, and how Glass or Lady Arryk could be sure that their answers lay there. All right. The past be damned. I'll go to your damned jugglers. But if this does work, what will we find?
Lady Arryk caused the image to disappear and another to spring into its place.
It was a machine of some kind, a sort of nightmare fusion of turbine, corkscrew and pine tree, all glittering, intertwining, and counter-rotating in ways that made my eyes hurt. Of course, I had seen it already. If not complete, then in a condition of partial assembly. It was the mechanism I had glimpsed through the little window in the partition during my first exploration of Scythe. The mechanism that Glass had been content to let me see, even if she had not seen fit to explain its presence in anything other than teasing illusion. A hypometric precursor device, Lady Arryk said. Good. I feel enormously enlightened. I paused. John the Revelator mentioned something about hypometric weapons. Is this the same thing? Let us say that it belongs to the same family of technologies, but it is not in itself a weapon. All right, I said slowly. That fits with what Glass told me when I asked her about the machine I'd seen inside Scythe. It's helpful that you've seen it, Lady Arryk said. I'm at least spared the tedium of persuading you that such a thing might exist. Permit me to assume a certain degree of ignorance on your part. Assume away. She took a breath. Years ago, we attempted to gain an advantage over the inhibitors by the use of hypometric weapons, instruments that performed certain operations on the local structure of space-time. With the hypometric weapons, we could reach inside the hull of a ship without disturbing a single atom of its structure, tunneling beneath reality, or snip a smaller ship or missile entirely out of existence. It's possible. I heard rumors. The Salmasis was picking up all sorts of transmissions as we fled to Michael, and some of them alluded to impossible weapons, or weapons stolen from the future. It would have been better if there had never been rumors. The hypometric weapons were a false dawn. They helped us survive a number of engagements, but they were too few in number, and too inexpertly controlled to offer a decisive advantage. In the end, we added them to the roll call of things that had failed us. Dark toys that should have remained in the toy box. You're going to give them a second try? No. That would be as futile as all the other attempts. And besides, the wolves learned from our limited successes and evolved counter-strategies of their own. But we have not exhausted the possibilities of hypometric technology. If our first efforts were atomic bombs, instruments of blunt destruction, what we make next will be an engine of creation. An atomic force microscope, by analogy. I thought back to what I remembered from our makeshift laboratories in Sun Hollow, our fumbling efforts to repair or maintain miniature systems. An atomic force microscope allows the manipulation of matter at the atomic scale. And by extension, a hypometric manipulator, this machine you see in hourglasses, constructor files, will operate on space-time at an analogous precision, fed a set of constructional schedules. A blueprint, if you will, it becomes a precursor technology, an intermediate step in the direction of something else, something utterly beyond our comprehension. What? Lady Arryk dropped her voice to a reverential whisper, as if what she meant to utter was too heretical or possibly blasphemous to voice in anything but the most hushed of tones. An incantor.